My, oh, my, oh, my. What is happening to the price of gasoline these days? It was supposed to be going down before the election, not up. Let's get David Bloom's take. Alcohol can be a gas when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Bloom, Executive Director, International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and author of, course, best-selling Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He is an advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm doing great, George. Glad to be here again.
You're doing better than the price of gasoline, I hope.
Oh, whenever the price of gas goes up, I do great, you know, but I wouldn't wish that on the American public, but it wakes us up, and waking up is always a good thing.
Well, there's no doubt. Now, when you were last with me, we were talking about gasoline dropping considerably before the November election. It's going the other way, Dave. What's going on?
Well, we were talking about the media saying that, and the media was saying, oh, it's going to go down to 3, and it's going to go below 3, and it's going to stay there for a long time. Well, what was going on then? What was going on then was quite a campaign by the oil companies to get rid of the renewable fuel standard. So what that is, of course, is the requirement that the oil companies put clean American alcohol in with the gasoline at increasing amounts over the years. So this year's amount of increase was really threatening to the oil companies, and so they went full tilt boogie to try to get rid of the renewable fuel standard before the election. They had several governors out there going to the EPA and saying, we need a waiver on this, and you and I did a discussion about this. They had several approaches, but the big one was blaming alcohol fuel for the shortage of corn.
Were they successful?
Well, have you heard anything about the drought or about shortage of corn lately?
No.
And so is there a shortage of corn if you're not hearing about it?
I see a lot of corn in the supermarkets.
Yeah, well, the point was this year, I mean, this is the level of lying that goes on by the gas and oil party. I mean, the gas and oil companies. When it comes to this kind of thing, basically, we had a surplus of corn this year, not a shortage. It was not as big a surplus as it has been the last few years, but there's no other way to spell surplus other than you got too much corn. So the complete fabrication about shortage of corn was out there primarily to try to kill alcohol as a fuel. And the EPA, who was tasked with deciding whether or not to waive the renewable fuel standard, told all these governors and the oil companies to just go away. Because basically what the EPA said was, if there's a shortage of corn, it's because of the drought, not because of ethanol. So again, the renewable fuel standard is what we have in this country that replaced the Clean Air Act in requiring that we have American renewable fuel instead of fossil fuel sold at the pump. And, you know, that's all we have left to keep the oil companies from having a total monopoly on the fuel supply.
Well, you know, I'm not a favor of genetically modified foods. So as far as I'm concerned, David, they should take all the corn, most of which is GMO, and use it for ethanol.
Well, that's true. The weird proteins that are produced in GMO corn are completely cooked in the alcohol production process. I mean, essentially, you make cornmeal mush out of the corn, you know, cooking it, boiling it, and that destroys all the funky proteins that GMOs create. So technically, you know, when you've done that, there's really not any more toxic materials. But, you know, alcohol fuel provides a market for corn that is not GMO modified. For instance, one of the biggest grain companies in the United States, again, they don't grow it, they buy it, is Archer Daniels Midland. And they do not buy a single kernel of GMO corn, even though they're one of the biggest corporations in the United States.
I did not know that. Well, anyways, with the price that is just skyrocketing right now, what's really the cause, David? What's behind this? I mean, in California, I saw it jump by like 60, 70 cents a gallon.
Oh, yeah. All around the country, it's jumping a huge amount. And the oil companies, whenever there is this kind of thing going on, what they do is what jets do when there's a missile coming after them. They throw lots of chaff in the air, you know, so they...
And hope for the best.
Yeah, and hoping that that medium missile will miss the oil company jet and hit one of these distractions. So what are some of the things that they're blaming it on? They're blaming it on, well, of course, ethanol. Ethanol is causing the price of fuel to go up.
How about Iran? They're blaming that. Right?
Yeah. Well, ethanol actually at the pump is, even with all the tax credits removed, courtesy of our wonderful Dianne Feinstein in California, there's no subsidies now for ethanol, and it's 60 to 70 cents a gallon cheaper than gasoline. So how does ethanol make the price of gas go up? Wow, that's a mystery to me. They blame Iran, which, oh my God, investors get nervous because Iran said something.
As a matter of fact, the story I had tonight, David, if Iran gets armed with a nuke, this is what the bipartisan committee is saying, that you can see another $2.75 a gallon increase here in the United States. Increase.
Well, you know, you got to remember that the president of Shell Oil in January said, oh, you'll see $5 a gallon before the end of the year.
He might be right.
And so, you know,
well, he is right.
They telegraph these things way in advance. You know, later on, you're going to say, yeah, I heard that somewhere, you know. So around the world, actually, price of gasoline is already $7 a gallon. You know, in the United States, here in California, we had one station selling it for $6.65 a gallon. But most of California is below $5. But that's not true in the rest of the world, where gasoline is not subsidized by income taxes like they are here. You know, for instance, when our president decided to go ahead and rebuild the roads in America, well, heck, what did they use to rebuild the roads, George?
The fuel taxes.
Well, yeah, but what was the material they used to make the roads with?
I don't know. You tell me.
Asphalt.
Of course. All right.
Asphalt's a waste product of the oil industry. It used to be about $300 a ton. But as soon as the country started buying a bunch of it to fix the roads, it went up to $1,000 a ton.
Oh,
so the oil companies make money no matter what you
do. Yeah, it's like making money on the donut hole, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. You know, so when you see high prices now, what you're seeing is a couple of things. One is negotiation. It's not like the oil companies favor either the oily cans or the dieselcrats. I mean, you know, basically there is a little divergence in how much money they give to their campaign funds, but they make deals with everyone. So what are they trying to do now? Well, they told Obama, if he did not approve the Keystone XL pipeline, which you and I have talked about on the show here, that there would be political punishment for that. So we're seeing that now. We're seeing, you know, whoever's on watch when the price of gas goes up gets, well, tarred and feathered, to make a bad pun. So what happened to Jimmy Carter when the price of oil went up? You know, it basically sunk his presidency. It just panicked the whole country. And, of course, Mitt Romney said the very first thing he will sign when he gets into office is the XL, Keystone XL pipeline, which is, you know, the most bizarre, toxic concoction ever figured out to keep Texas oil men alive by shipping gooey tar in a solvent 1,500 miles to Texas just so they don't have to shut down.
Well, do you think this increase, David, is manipulated because of the election?
There's a number of agendas, but this is when the oil companies want to extract deals. Well, it's no problem for the contenders for the title, meaning the, you know, the gas and oil party, but the dieselcrats, you know, they want to retake or stay in office. And so if they want the oil prices to go down, they have to make concessions to the big oil companies on the sly. And so what you see is when the prices go up, are deals made. And so they may not come to light for a few weeks or months, but you can bet that Obama is having to think long and hard about whether he compromises on, you know, whether or not to regulate fracking and the 30 trillion gallons of toxic waste that have been, you know, injected.
Well, he's only got a couple weeks left. He's got to make up his mind pretty soon, don't you think?
Yeah, I think he's trying to hold out, because it's been very popular for him to stand up to the oil companies and say, no, you're not going to pollute our country. But it's going to cost him politically. And, well, you've got, you know, the weird paradox is you've got Romney out in Iowa, you know, saying that he's in favor of the renewable fuel standard in ethanol.
Right.
When he's in front of farmers, and then when he's in front of everyone else, he says, I want to get rid of all solar and wind credits and all renewable credits and go, go, go for drilling and, you know, more oil offshore. which of course is incredibly dangerous. And right now, all of our offshore oil only amounts to a quarter of what we produce from alcohol in this country right now. We already swamp all that, but there's money in them there oceans.
Well, how much pressure, you know, do people like you have on you with people who just don't want to use ethanol?
You mean like basically from the gas and oil?
Yeah, or whomever.
You know, it's really funny how those guys advertise on a lot of media. You ever notice that, George? And I never see any of those ads on your show.
No, where's all the money? I got it.
And I'm sorry, George, just because you have me on, because
you're the reason I don't get those advertising
dollars. That's right. So my apologies for that, but you know, it's only the few courageous journalists that can stand up to the power of the biggest corporations on earth, who have more money than, well,
God.
Certain deities. Yeah.
Yeah. You can say God on the show, Dave.
Isn't that one of the seven FCC words or something?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay,
great. Far from it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what we're talking about here, just bare-knuckle capitalism. And, you know, it's business as usual. This is not strictly a conspiracy, although we can talk about that.
Well, are we going to see the prices go down at all? Because I got to tell you, right now, they're ridiculous.
Okay, well, most of us don't have the means to play the futures market. But some of us go to bars and we bet with our friends, you know, like what's going to happen. And, you know, I've made quite a few $100 bills doing my own version of futures market trading in the local bar. So here's my predictions. And if you are have the nerve, you can bet on these with your friends. So here's what will happen. It's not certain if the price will go down before the election, because it depends on if Obama makes deals. But after the election, no matter who wins, it'll go down until March. And then, as we've published this before, you know, actually for you, where we talk about how in every election, the following March has an unexplained spike of gasoline prices, which is the payoff for the oil company's support, no matter who wins the election. Now, when the oily cans win, the spike is bigger. When the dieselcrats win, the spike is lower. But there's always a spike
there's
in the following
spike.
March.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to take the chance of embarrassment when we talk in March, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, basically, I think we're looking at the usual pattern.
All right. Well, this is squeezing Americans. I'm amazed that the automobile industry is staying as strong as it is.
You know, the automobile industry is in a funny place. You know, recently, Ford and GM just endorsed E15 or 15% alcohol in fuel, saying they are warranting all their cars for it. So
that's a good thing? You support that?
Well, absolutely. Every time we increase the amount of alcohol that is put in the American fuel supply, that makes it that much harder for the oil companies to crush alcohol out of business, because they have to put it in the fuel when a state demands it. So what they've been saying until recently is, well, we don't have to put in more than 10%, because the federal government says all they have to put in is 10%. So you little states, well, we don't care about your states' rights anymore. You know, we're not going to raise the amount of alcohol because we have federal, you know, a federal trump of your demand. Well, but the EPA went out there and tested almost every vehicle from 2001 forward and found, oh, this works great. It's not a problem. It reduces emissions and doesn't hurt any cars. So get that, folks. The EPA proved that alcohol in the gas does not hurt cars. Now, you know, you and I talked, George, about when Daryl Hannah and I, in advance of
who, by the way, just got arrested, didn't she?
Yeah. She's complaining,
she was protesting,
as you can imagine, about fracking and about non-renewable fuels once again. And, you know, Daryl drives her Kill Bill, Trans Am Firebird on alcohol. We converted that car for her.
Yep.
And,
that.
She continues to press for our getting off of dangerous fossil fuels. But she helped us using that car, proving a year in advance that old cars would run on E15. We did a press conference in Sacramento. We had the Kill Bill car there. We had absolutely immaculate California emission control equipment there. And they showed right there that over a 90% decrease in the amount of emissions when we used 85% alcohol in her old car. So we clean up the air, we make jobs for people, lots of jobs, and we don't import any more oil. You know, those seem to add up to pretty good numbers to me, but there's certain people that won't make money if we go that way. And there's other folks, like farmers, who will suddenly be able to keep their farms because they have a better price for their crop.
Where's this all leading, David? What's going to happen, do you think, the next 5 years?
Well, you know, you and I, you know, disagree about a little bit about how much oil is available.
Right. But you believe in peak oil. I believe in abiotic.
Well, you know, we'll have a great talk about that sometime, George.
Well, yeah.
Detail, but let me tell you, it doesn't matter. Because
the great thing about discussion is you can discuss.
Yes, yes.
I don't shout at you. You know that.
No. Maybe you should sometimes. But
no,
at any rate, agree on one thing for sure, that even if that oil's, you know, in profusion down there below 15,000 feet, we saw in the Gulf what happens when we try to drill that deep. And we really don't have that down. And it's what we call now, even if it's there, I have not visited 15,000 feet below the ground, so I can't prove you're wrong about this, George. But if it is down there, we don't really know a safe way of getting it out. We're talking about oil that's under 10,000 pounds per square inch pressure. It's hundreds of degrees above, you know, Fahrenheit hot. It has, you know, a huge quantity of natural gas mixed in it. It's extreme oil. And that's what we're facing. It's not necessarily peak oil. I'll give you that, George. There is stuff down there. But it's very dangerous, difficult, and expensive to extract.
Well, you've always heard me say, David, I don't think we should be using oil.
It's the wrong stuff.
Fuel source. I mean, we should use it. And I have no problems with it in plastics and everything else that they have to use it for.
That's 1% of the oil for plastics.
So be it.
Well, you know, someday in the future, George, the kids are going to, like, look at us and say, you guys burned oil in cars? You know how valuable this stuff is? I mean, and you guys just burned it? You know, it's like, yes, that stuff is definitely really cool. But right now it's floating on the top of the Gulf. There's a 4-mile slick out there that nobody is taking credit for. And when you and I did all that coverage of the whole Gulf disaster, what did we say? We said it was going to come back up. You know, it floats on the bottom in these huge clouds with all that Corexit, the solvent they use to try to make it look like there wasn't so much. And good old Robert Dudley, you know, from BP, you know, Dudley Do-Right said, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. The cleanup's finished. But it wasn't. It's just down there at 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. And when the weather changes, it comes to the surface. The bacteria eat the solvent, corrects it, and the oil floats on top. And so we got a 4-mile slick out there right now. And so where's BP? Oh, no. We mission accomplished. We finished cleaning up already. Don't talk to us.
David, every time you're on, everybody wants to know about how they can make their own little distillery for ethanol. And also, you tell these great stories about the cattails and how they can be used as well. So let's talk about some of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. With the Split Show, we'll take your phone calls next hour with David Bloom. Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. More to come on Coast to Coast AM with David Bloom. Well, if you get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, look at the highlights reel. You'll see the little information on Ghost to Ghost, which is coming up on Halloween night. We'd like to hear some of your ghost stories. You can send an email to ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com. There's a link for you at our website at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, David. We're going to talk about these little distilleries people can make and create. But tell us these great stories again. I love the cattail stories you talk about on how they can be used also for fuel.
Well, you know, the whole thing about using other crops for fuel is to show that there are many ways to make alcohol. This is not about corn or sugarcane as the only crops, and we have to, like, plaster one or two crops over the whole country to get our fuel. What we're talking about with my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, you know, is teaching people how to make alcohol from all kinds of things that nature produces. Because, you know, what we're talking about here are carbohydrates. So what's a carbohydrate? Well, this carbohydrate is carbon dioxide from the air, water, which is hydration, right? So carbohydrate is water, carbon dioxide, and solar energy. So when we glue those together in a plant, it's called photosynthesis, and that's sugars. You know, basically the same sugars that we get out of sugar cane, like sucrose, or we convert from cornstarch into fructose, and, you know, many, many other sugars. And starch, of course, is a carbohydrate, too. So we typically, on the small scale, the scale you or I would do it, George, we'd make it out of those two things, sugars or starches. Now, people think, well, heck, where do I go out and get a sack of starch to make alcohol with? Well, you know, if you're a farmer, you can grow many crops to produce starch. And cattails are a really good starch crop. But there's a lot of waste, too, which we could talk a little bit more when probably people ask questions. But when it comes to cattails, they have almost as much starch in them as corn grain. You know, 60%+ of a corn grain is starch. And we can, you know, just like moonshiners of old, we can break that down with enzymes. They used to use sprouted barley to get the enzymes, like when you make beer. And we use a little cheaper enzymes now that they make in factories. But we go ahead and break that down into sugars, and we give it to yeast, the same yeast that make our bread or make our beer, you know, or make our wine. The same yeast eat those sugars, and they basically excrete the alcohol. So, you know, the tank that you're doing this in fills up with yeast poop over a period of hours or days. And when it gets up to maybe 10-12% alcohol, the yeast are totally drunk and they keel over. And now you've got, you know, like if you're making it from donuts, you've got donut wine, you know, goes really great with French fries, you know. So, So anyway, we boil that up in a distillery, and that separates the alcohol from the donut wine. And now we have donut whiskey. And, you know, if we're making it strong enough, like 90% or greater purity, we can use that to run cars, to run generators. That's right. You can go off the grid with alcohol. We can actually run refrigerators with it without electricity. That's an old way of using it. And also, it's really important around the world when we're talking about small stills, like you've brought up, for cooking, because half the world cooks over wood or kerosene right now. You know, we don't think about that much because we have natural gas or electricity here, but most people in the world, and I mean by most, more than 50%, do not have that luxury. They have to use, you know, basically they're cooking over a campfire in their kitchen, and you can imagine what the smoke is like in there. But with alcohol, there's no emissions whatsoever. So we can use alcohol for all these things, and we can make it in a way that is not patentable. I mean, it's been around, you know, longer than anything else. And so, you know, the thing that drives the big gas and oil companies crazy is there's no way to really control alcohol production because you and I can do it. Now, when it comes to making it practically on the small scale, you know, your time's valuable. And so in my book, you know, we talk about making around 8 to 10 gallons per hour at a minimum, because then you can knock out a whole month's worth of fuel in a few hours on one day. You know, and that, considering how busy everybody is, that's probably about right, you know, for the smallest case. Now, there are small stills out there that basically are a byproduct of the workshops I taught back in the 1980s when I was researching my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And some of those are still out there, and they're, you know, they sell little sets of plans. We even sell plans that one of my students generated, and you know, and those will allow you to make a gallon or a gallon and a half an hour. So it's a good way to learn how to make alcohol. But, you know, George, you've been asking me about this for years, and we're almost there. Bloom Distillation has been put together. Our distillery.
It's about time.
Well, I know you told me to do it. I kept waiting for someone else to do it, but we got tired of waiting. So we're now building prototypes, and we're going to start delivering distilleries next year for small business. And, you know, in the early part of next year. And so we just, our first one actually is going to be somewhat large. It's going to be a still that will produce many thousands of gallons a year. And we're doing it for a school in Mexico, you know, which is going to teach its farmers how to make alcohol from desert plants like agave. You know, agave, the stuff we make into tequila?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story, right? So 6 years ago, all of a sudden a lot of people started drinking more tequila. And what farmers always do when there's a shortage one year, like there was a shortage of agave for tequila, is everybody plants it. So the trouble, though, with agave is it takes 6 years to grow before you harvest it. So no one really understood just how much a surplus there was of agave that had been planted until last year. And all of a sudden they realized that there are not enough tequila drinkers in the world for all this agave they're growing in the deserts of Mexico. And so they're trying to talk the Chinese into drinking tequila, and that's not going well. So all these farmers, if they don't make alcohol from the agave, it sends up a big seed shoot 30 feet in the air, and the plant dies after it reproduces. So suddenly Mexico wants to save all these literally tens of thousands of agave farmers who are making a living in the desert with virtually no water and growing a valuable crop producing over 1,000 gallons of fuel a year. So, you know, this is a boon to small-scale farmers all over arid parts of the world. And the government of Mexico has called upon us to put together a piece of equipment that farmers can use on the small and medium scale, and it will be training for it. It'll be at a university in Mexico.
And you can do it year-round, right?
There, you can do it year-round because it's almost tropical there. And many crops actually are year-round. So we started this discussion with cattails. So, and I wandered off into agave, but cattails are great because we can grow those for the purpose of cleaning up water. So we recently had a meeting with an industrialist in China who said there are 2,200 cities in China that are about 1 million people, and none of them have sewage treatment. Only bigger cities have sewage treatment, and that's typical around the world. Cattails can be used really economically to take all the nutrients, the surplus nutrients, which we sometimes call sewage. We can use those as fertilizer to grow the cattails in, of course, standing water. That's how cattails grow. They're a marsh plant, and they produce so much starch in their roots, their rhizomes, the little horizontal roots, that that it's 20 times the yield of corn. So here we are taking a renewable waste product, because believe me, sewage is as renewable as it gets, you know. And, I mean, if we start running out of sewage, it means something's really wrong. So, you know, so we turn that sewage into fuel, and then that fuel can, in the case of a Latin American country that we're working with now, will run the city's generators using the city's sewage. So the alcohol will run the generators. Byproducts will be high-protein cattle feed for the farmers from the leaves. I mean, we are making huge strides in not just taking this as a funny story, but making this a real answer for municipalities and small towns and cities that can't really afford to process their sewage. And that incorporates the entire developing world, as well as many, many small towns in the United States.
What a great program. Mm-hmm. It really is. And you can expand it possibly, huh?
Oh, yeah. This can be done around the world. And, you know, the research we're doing with the Department of Agriculture and some American universities has backed up everything we've been saying for years about cattails. And the exciting discovery, of course, is that we will be able to feed people and animals with byproducts from this that are, you know, of course, sterile after we cook it and make alcohol. But it's not every day you get to solve the world food crisis and the energy crisis all in one step.
No, that's true, too, David. Absolutely. Worldwide, are they relying on ethanol?
Well, you know, that's a great question, George, because you would think, you know, you would think that if it's such a good idea, well, gosh, why isn't everyone doing it? And, of course, listeners to your show know that there are many reasons why things don't happen that have nothing to do with practicality or logic. So politics is often the issue. Now, some politics are different than other politics. So, you know, there's this little country down in Latin America called Brazil, you know. I mean, it's almost as big as the United States. It's just enormous. And they don't import any oil there, you know. They don't need to, because they make alcohol, and 95% of all new cars made in Brazil are made to run on both alcohol and gas. and pretty close to 90% of all the cars in Brazil run on alcohol or gas. In other words, they're able to run on both. So, and the reason is that alcohol is typically, in most years, half the price of gasoline. So people want to use whatever is cheaper, alcohol or gasoline, but there's a huge effect, and we need to pay attention to this because, we need to look at this in our country. There's over 1 million union sugarcane workers in Brazil that produce the sugarcane for fuel. It's the most stable agricultural employment in that whole country. And in the United States, if we replaced all of our gasoline with alcohol, which we can do, we would recover 26 million jobs, many more than were lost in the Bush economic debacle.
That's amazing.
And they're permanent jobs because, what did I say, alcohol is made from solar energy. You know, the solar energy that falls on our land is converted into fuel in our country, and you can't export our sunlight to anyone. So, you know, basically it has to be made here, and we sell it, you know, in the United States right now in many different ways. The most common way, of course, is 10% blended with gas, but that's like kind of wasting it, you know. It's like using really good cognac to make, you know, a rum and coke or something. It's like, why are we putting this really great fuel in with gasoline, of all things? But we do sell E85 in this country, which is 85% alcohol and only 15% gasoline. There's a whole long story of that debacle and why we still have 15% in that. But basically, you can buy alcohol at the pump now and use it in your car. Now, you know, the cars that are flex fuel, like the one Ford gave me, the nice F-150 that I drove.
And explain flex fuel to people.
Well, it's like what I've seen in Brazil. The cars run on both alcohol or gasoline because the fuels are actually pretty similar when it comes to running a car. And the computers just have to have a little bit more data so that they can easily move between any mixture of alcohol to any mixture of gasoline. So you're talking about less than $50 on the assembly line to make a car capable of running on both. And we do that in this country. Ford, GM, Dodge, and now increasingly, you know, companies like Toyota and Nissan and, you know, all the other companies are now moving on because the whole world is going to alcohol. And the quickest way to go there is to make it possible for people to put whatever they want in the tank and not think about it. We're not the only country that likes convenience. Everyone wants this. So so we find in places like in Scandinavia, for those of you who haven't looked at a map lately, that's up there north of Europe, okay? So it's, you know, like Denmark and Sweden, all these countries, they are all deciding that they aren't going to be ordering any more oil from anyone because their fields are exhausted. They used to have a lot of fields off of Norway. And so they're all talking like by 2016 to 2020, depending on the country, not using any more gasoline for running their cars. They're already starting to build cars there that will not run on gasoline. They are only high-performance cars designed to run on alcohol that have tiny engines with huge horsepower because alcohol is 105 octane. And they're going to be getting as good or better mileage in gasoline vehicles, you know, so there's really no penalty. And, of course, they'll be lots cheaper than gasoline because, you know, they can grow beets there. They grow these enormous 15-pound beets in Sweden. They grow Jerusalem artichokes. And that, of course, has nothing to do with Jerusalem or artichokes, but they're a funny-looking tuber that, you know, is full of carbohydrates. And we have worked with scientists to use a yeast, a natural yeast that was found on a banana leaf in Panama that will eat the weird carbohydrates and things like Jerusalem artichokes or cheese whey and stuff and make alcohol directly without any fancy, you know, patented techniques to, you know, hydrolyze it. And that's, you know, that's something that the kinds of things that Bloom Distillation is doing is bringing these technologies out from behind the corporate veil and putting it out there where people can actually use it and buy it, and it's, you know, it's not going to be unavailable anymore like so many of the things that have been patented in the last few years by big corporations.
Will you go public?
Someday, you know, I mean, our corporation right now is private, and due to the rules of the SEC, you know, we can't offer it to the public until a later point. You know, you have to be a more established company to do that. But yeah, we do have people who are participating with us financially and making the company go. And you're going to like this, George. When it comes to the oil companies, we have something to say to them. AFU. Now, before you jump to conclusions, that means our new alcohol fuel university. And we just this week, put in our offer and got accepted to buy a campus in rural California, in Watsonville, California, south of Santa Cruz, where we are going to be growing all these different energy crops for people to see. We're going to be having different size distilleries there and courses in how to be in the alcohol business.
How many cars do you think you'll be able to handle, let's say, the first year?
Well, it's not the cars. We're not making alcohol for sale. What we're doing is showing people how to make alcohol at our university campus.
Well, no, but I mean, eventually, aren't you going to make it yourself?
We're going to be making the equipment. Well, I mean, I could do that right now, George. I could make plenty of alcohol for 50 cents a gallon and sell it for $3, and I could retire. But that's not my goal, because my goal is to take down the oil companies. You know, I'm just a little modest when it comes to things like that. So what we're doing is building...
They'll stomp on you, David.
No, they won't take me seriously. They don't, and they won't, because we're talking about small stills here. We're talking about stills that make 20,000 gallons up to 500,000 gallons of fuel a year. That's like a rounding error to the oil
companies. But then what happens when some of these gasoline stations convert to ethanol 100%?
Well, again, they're not going to take it seriously. They'll think it's way too small to be of any importance, and they'll count on the average American doing what he's always done and buying gasoline and going to work so that he can get the money to buy the gasoline and just stay on that treadmill. They're not going to take this seriously. They haven't taken me seriously for 20 years. And so that's our camouflage, George. You know, it's the attack of the mosquitoes, right? If we're all a bunch of little mosquitoes, one day the oil companies will turn around and go, "Where's my blood?" You know, we'll have drained their capital. But, you know, until then, they're just going to laugh at us. All these people with little stills that are making, you know, enough fuel for 100 people or 300 people.
You know what? That's good. That's fine, isn't it?
I think it's perfect. It's the Briar Patch strategy. Don't throw me in the Briar Patch. You know, it's the, you know, what the rabbit used to say, you know, to the I guess it was the wolf that had him, you know. I can't remember now.
Out the old book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, because we're going to take phone calls in just a second here with you, David, right here. And if people need to email you, David, how do they do that?
Oh, info@alcoholcanbeagas.com. And, you know, oh, God, George, you just had me give the website again. Oh, the last time we did this, you completely cooked our server.
Sorry.
Yeah, you can get a hold of us at Alcohol Can Be a Gas, the website, or if you need to email us, info@alcoholcanbeagas.com.
Okay, final hour to go with you, David. We'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.